We'll pass the time for argument in Baker v. Exxon. This is a very senior, distinguished panel consisting of the Chief Judge of this Court, the Chief Judge Emeritus of this Court, and our distinguished colleague from the State of Alaska. And we have all been here before, so we will proceed to hear the case. And we will not be rigid in the time limit given, which is only 20 minutes per side. We will not interrupt you in the middle of a one-syllable word. So, but we are very familiar with both the law and the facts of this particular case and want to concentrate on exactly what this panel needs to decide now. So, with that, we'll hear from the appellants.
Good morning. Good morning, Chief Judge Schroeder. May it please the Court. I'll try to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. And since, as you said, that you have been over this before, it's probably best that I start with what's new since you last heard argument in this case. And by far the most important new development is the Supreme Court's decision in State Farm versus Campbell. In State Farm, in one key respect, the Supreme Court turned an important element of punitive damages law right side up. The Court rejected the notion, an understandable but mistaken notion, that somehow the largest compensatory judgments necessarily call for the largest punitive damages. The Court said that's not right. In fact, if you focus on the necessity of punishment and deterrence, the Court recognized that large compensatory costs may already accomplish both of those objectives, punishment and deterrence. And just let me read you the sentence of the way the Court precisely says that it should be presumed that a plaintiff has been made whole for his injuries by compensatory damages. So punitive damages should only be awarded if the defendant's culpability, after having paid compensatory damages, is so reprehensible as to warrant the imposition of further sanctions necessary to achieve punishment and deterrence. That very new way of looking at it was actually foreshadowed by this Court's November 2001 opinion, in which you noted that it was a close question whether punitive damages were simply barred in this case, that there was, you said, force of logic and policy to the argument that punishment and deterrence had already been satisfied when over $3,000 million had been imposed in costs and voluntary cleanup on the defendant in this case. The only thing that was missing was precedent. And I think the Supreme Court's decision in State Farm supplies that precedent. Now, we're not asking this panel to revisit the decision not to strike the punitive damages claim, but we certainly believe that the considerations that strongly suggested that under this approach of State Farm, no punitive damage award is permissible, suggest a fortiori that no such award should exceed $25 million. Surely the payment of $3.5 billion is one of the greatest deterrents we've ever seen in the civil law, and that leads to the question of whether there is an amount necessary for punishment. And here, unusually in this case, we don't have to speculate.
Counsel?
Yes, Judge Kleinfeld.
I'm puzzled by something here. In our previous opinion, we spent about 13 pages going over what the amount should be after first trudging through all the issues that led up to whether there could be punitive damages at all. We rejected the arguments acknowledging that some were close on whether there should be punitive damages and said it was allowable. Then in the 13 or so pages of F3rd going over the amount, we went at it every which way, and we kept coming up to a number around $1.1, $1.2 billion. Your brief says the district court ignored the mandate of this court, and you cited a lot of authority that a lower court is bound by the mandate of the higher court, and it doesn't matter that the lower court thinks the higher court was wrong or didn't have good enough authority for it. But it sounds like you're doing the same thing. You're saying we shouldn't do what we said before was the right thing to do. Instead, we should basically erase the punitives award. I don't get it. How could we do that without applying that rarely applied branch of law of the case doctrine that allows a court to erase its prior decision on account of its being plainly wrong?
Judge Kleinfeld, two responses. One, I don't think we have to fight the court's prior opinion. I recognize that there were places where you mentioned among the numbers twice the amount of the loss under one statute, et cetera, that produced a number of $1 billion, but you by no means did I read your opinion as suggesting that is the answer. And we do have, indeed, I think, a powerful.
Nevertheless, we said at the end of it that our mandate was that the district court should recalculate consistently with this opinion.
That is correct. But I think consistent with the opinion that you wrote, you did say what was necessary for punishment and deterrence. And I'll go through the opinion. The second answer is I do think that State Farm is a very major development since you wrote that opinion. That is to say, the part of the opinion that says it's a close, your analysis about
how does State Farm change our opinion as opposed to showing that where there was no clear authority before, now we had the Supreme Court saying we were right? Your previous argument is basically where there was no clear authority before on one of the issues we tackled, the Supreme Court said we were right.
Well, in two respects. First of all, State Farm says, you all said there's logic and policy to the notion that this kind of cost might simply rule out punitives because there's no predicate for punishment deterrence. The court said for the first time that only if a defendant's culpability after having paid compensatories is so reprehensible as to warrant further sanctions, really endorsing that. Secondly, your opinion noted a number of numbers, some of which are that the comparable penalty, you noted, there was an agreement of $150 million, which was reduced to $25 million for reasons that are directly germane, it seems to us to be, the correct number. You also said in the opinion that it is generally not proper to count in the what you call the numerator for ratio purposes amounts that have been paid in settlement. And that makes all the sense in the world, because here what you had was often efforts at a solution where you have purely economic injury and there is prompt payment. $300 million paid out within 2 years. I think the chart starts on the excerpts of record at page 456 of when those payments were made. $300 million paid out. The bulk of it, that chart will show in the fall of 1989. You've, in many cases, before the economic loss has been suffered, it makes sense to look at the fact, as you said in your opinion, that the judgment was for, we know precisely what the judgment was for, it's $19,500,000, then that doesn't, you know, the ratio never binds you. But it also is a case in which the other thing the Supreme Court says in State Farm, I believe for the first time, is that where compensatory damages are substantial, and that was $1 million in State Farm, where compensatory damages are substantial, then a lesser ratio, perhaps only equal to compensatory damages, can reach the outermost limits of the due process guarantee. If that's not this case, I don't know what case it would be. If $3,000 million isn't substantial.
What do you understand the numerator to be in this case, the measure of it?
The measure in this case, the numerator would be $20.3 million, and that consists of the judgment in the case. It's the usefulness of the ratio is it does give you a real number. It's not binding. If there are other considerations, if there are other factors, the court says there's no magic ceiling, but it does give you a fixed number to start with. In this case, at page 404.
Oh, no, what do you – I don't want to know the fixed number. I just – how do you calculate it? What, in your mind, what is it in any case, looking at State Farm and then extrapolating? Because I may have a different idea.
In any case, I think the numerator is the compensatory damages paid as a result of the judgment.
Paid? See, I read that it's the harm that basically is suffered by the plaintiffs, which is compensatory damages, but in formally. But State Farm talks about punishing for its actions against the Campbells.
Well, as this Court noted, the harm was largely avoided, economic injury, by prompt early payment. It's the reason that, and I don't otherwise know if Judge...
That, the prompt recovery avoided further harm, it seems to me.
Well,
it hasn't reduced the number of the harm that you caused as a result of the accident. It may have been reduced further compensatory.
Well, let me just give you one example, Judge Roeder, where I think that is, it is clearly that takes into account, and it accounts for a lot of the $303 million that was paid out. Where you're paying people who anticipate an economic loss for the next season, and you make a payment, you set up claims offices and make a payment in advance of the loss having suffered. That's what makes sense of what this Court said. I mean, Judge Kleinfeld asked me about the mandate of the holding, and this Court says that the amount that a defendant voluntarily pays before judgment should generally not be used as part of the numerator in punitive damages review because that would deter settlements prior to judgment. That was a considered judgment. This Court noted that the net compensatory damages were $19,590,000.
I understand your argument with respect to that language, and it cites opinions with which I am quite familiar. And I have a pretty good idea of what I thought we meant by that. But I'm just asking in terms of the State Farm analysis, which is what's new. We haven't seen it before, and that's really as you started your argument. It seems to me the focus of the State Farm argument of that case is that the Utah Supreme Court was way off base in looking at the damages, focusing on overall damage caused to around the country by this policy, as opposed to the harm that was caused to these plaintiffs. And so I'm just suggesting to you that as I read State Farm, the numerator should be the harm that was caused to these plaintiffs.
Well, precisely what State Farm used for the numerator was the actual amount of the judgment of $1 million. They used that as the numerator, even though in some ways that may have, they noted that included both some amounts that could be seen as punitive, but in any event,
right.
And it seems to me that once you start trying to move away from.
And then the punitives in that case wound up being hundreds of times greater than that.
It was. And the Court has noted that it seems useful to me to start with, the ratio is useful to start with as a comparison of what was the compensatory judgment actually paid and what was the punitive judgment actually paid. And it gives you a number that's not – doesn't determine your outcome. In this case, I mean, it may be that is principally about deterrence in any event. And in this case, I think this is a case in which deterrence has been so fully satisfied by the amount that we look to penalties. And if you look to the criminal and civil penalties as a comparison, they too bring you very much in line with this number. I mean, usually courts are in the position of saying, what might a criminal fine realistically be expected to be? And here, the senior law enforcement officials of both the United States and the state of Alaska agreed that the appropriate amount of punishment under the Alternative Fines Act, 3571D, would be $25 million. I mean, you did mention the sum of $150 million.
What is the basis for calculating the fine?
The basis for calculating the fine by those two officials was the amount that they thought appropriate as punishment, and at the sentencing hearing under those regulations.
Why should that be determinative here after State Farm, where State Farm says that you're supposed to look at the actions that were that affected these plaintiffs and the harm that was caused them.
Well, because it I understand that to ascertain the harm component, you're looking at the harm to these plaintiffs, not to the environment, et cetera. And to be sure, the $25 million that was one of the largest fines, not the largest ever imposed, that $25 million was for all of the harm, including the harm to economic interest. It was
in order to compensate these plaintiffs?
It was a fine for that injury. Of course, the punitive damage is not to compensate the plaintiffs in any case. Punitive damage is,
I understand that. I'm asking about the proper calculation of the compensation that is appropriate to compensate these plaintiffs for the economic harm. And it seems to me that is the economic harm that was suffered by these plaintiffs. That's, and I'm just telling you, why is that wrong? Why should we jump over and talk about fines under a criminal system?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had answered your question. Let me be precise about the numerator. It seems to me that under what this court said in its prior opinion about generally not taking into account the amounts that a defendant has voluntarily paid before the judgment, taking into account the fact that if you want to have a useful ratio, it's useful to have objective numbers, and the objective number here is the judgment that was paid, that number makes sense. I don't know where else I could go with that answer except to say that it seems to me that the proper calculation of what the compensatory judgment was is $19,500 plus $700,000 from state court judgment, which is what comes to 20.3, and the amount of punitives, the other factor in the ratio will be whatever punitive damage amount is appropriate will constitute that ratio. Again, that's not binding. And it doesn't, in my view, lead to an absurd result in the sense that it takes account, as did the state and federal officials, of the amelioration brought about by the efforts of the company in spending $2 billion.
We take into account what the company has done in preventing more damage, in reducing the amount that these plaintiffs should be regarded as needing to compensate them for their harm?
I would not see it as reduction. I would see it as you start with the compensatory judgment, which was $19.5 million.
Now, I guess that takes into account all this mitigation.
Yes, and they would have you add to that.
No, well, I'm asking you to look at it the other way. Can't you also argue that you're asking that we take away all these things and that in State Farm, they were saying, no, you look at what was the harm suffered by these plaintiffs. You don't look at what was suffered by other plaintiffs that may be compensable in other suits, but you look at these plaintiffs in
this
suit.
Yes, I understand that. And for purposes of harm, for the ratio, you look at that. Now, the other guidepost, it seems to me, the civil penalty, in our view, the potential fine was $28 million. They started at 80, but they realized it doesn't take account of the cleanup, which reduces it to $64 million. In our brief, we set out starting at page 44 why we think that's $28 million. But the debate is really between $28 million and $64 million. And we've never had a better guide on criminal penalties in any punitive damage case I look at, because the government's actually went through and resolved that issue and decided that it should not be $150 million, but $25 million in count of all the activities. So those are both relevant data. And when you look at – and the reason is, of course, that when you look at reprehensibility, when you ask whether this should be an exception to the statement in State Farm that 1-to-1 is the appropriate ratio in cases of substantial compensatories – this has to be the case with the size of the compensatories and the absence of reprehensibility, since this accident was an accident.
Counsel, I wonder if your colloquy with Judge Schroeder is mixing two issues together that need to be separated. When we said held, according to Baines versus Arco, it was holding, in our previous decision in this case, that the amount that a defendant voluntarily pays before judgment should generally not be used as part of the numerator. That holding was in the context of analyzing the ratio.
Yes.
However, as I understand the thrust of Judge Schroeder's inquiries to you, they go not only to ratio but to reprehensibility. We did not suggest in the reprehensibility analysis that that $300 million of harm should not be considered. So what I'm thinking is that the proper analysis is, in terms of considering how reprehensible the conduct is, look at the money that was voluntarily paid after the harm was done. In terms of the ratio, don't. Am I getting that right?
Yes, I do think we should separate those out. And with respect to reprehensibility, the early payments, as has been recognized by this court's opinion and by the officials, should reduce at least or mitigate any reprehensibility. But if you look at reprehensibility itself, what you see is what this court said. There was no violence. There was no intentional spilling, no trickery. That all goes to what is missing from this case.
How does what they do later to pay claims to reduce their compensatory damages, how does that affect the reprehensibility of the original conduct?
It doesn't. It cannot affect the reprehensibility of the original conduct, but it can overall assessing what is necessary
that's
for punishment and deterrence. But let's look at the original. It'd be useful to look at the original.
That's where I'm hanging up, too. I don't see how it mitigates reprehensibility. It seems to me it affects the ratio only. I mean, suppose, to take a hypothetical case, you had a company that engaged in a practice that was dangerous to its workers. And it knew perfectly well that from time to time there'd be accidents that killed workers. So whenever one of them was killed, the company went to the widow, gave her $25 million, kept a lot of the widows quiet. It's reprehensible as can be, even if the ratio is reduced.
Yes, I fully understand that. And that's why I want to, if I may, address reprehensibility directly.
Yeah, but it seems to me, let me just give you where I'm coming from, and then we'll give the other side equal time. But it seems to me that the what they pay out in cleanup and early claims does reduce their compensatory liability. But I don't see why you should, so that we get a compensation, that the compensatory damages are reduced. But I don't see why we have to use that as the reduced figure as the numerator figure for the ratio. Because State Farm says you look at what happened to these plaintiffs. And by the conduct, the original conduct, not everything that they do after the conduct to mitigate compensatory damage.
Let me respond to that and then just briefly address reprehensibility itself,
please.
Which is, I read State Farm to say you exclude from consideration harm done to other people who are not plaintiffs before you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're limited to looking at the harm the plaintiffs before you and what they looked at in State Farm, and you should look at here, I think it's compensatory damage that was actually paid as part of the ratio. Now, on reprehensibility, what is missing from this case that you see in punitive damage cases are one of two things. You either see generally an intentional malice targeted against a victim where punitives are clearly called for. Probably more commonly what you see in punitive damage cases is a circumstance where someone is trying to save money by taking known safety risks to save money on a product because it's got to make another $35 per car if they put the gas tank in one place rather than another. That's missing from both of these, from this case. This was an accident. No company would ever want to incur $3.5 billion in liability. This wasn't something where you had a plan, a harm that you hoped to achieve. What they hoped for was safe passage. So the accidental nature of this, which has been recognized by this court, we think is really what reduces reprehensibility. And I think that when you look at the ratio, if the numerator is anything other than 20 million, where we think that already triggers a 1-to-1 ratio, then I would think that the proper ratio could be substantially less than 1-to-1. And a case where, and that's the central message of State Farm, and I'd like to save a little bit of time for rebuttal.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, and you've more than used your time, but we'll give the other, set the clock for 25 minutes, and we'll let you talk on.
In these circumstances, that is, a tanker spill that hurt tens of thousands of people and caused hundreds of millions of dollars of damage, the district court's award is not grossly excessive for a variety of reasons. If you consider only the quantified harm, the award is presumptively it's within the presumptively constitutional single-digit guideline. If you take into account uncompensated harm and potential harm, as TXO teaches, the real ratio falls to less than 4-1.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
This reminds me, this argument would appear to start from scratch, and it seems to me you have to start from the previous decision because that was the result of very considerable consideration, and it's since been followed in other decisions of this court and absorbed in this court's precedents. So I don't quite see how you start from scratch.
Let me address the proposition that I'm starting from scratch. Since this court's decision, we've had a number of decisions in this circuit, Cooper being the best example, in which the actual practice of the courts with regard to punitive damage awards is in affirming.
Before the Supreme Court reversed us in Cooper?
After the Supreme Court reversed you in Cooper, which is why I think it's significant. That pass on punitive damage awards where the single-digit ratios, where there are single-digit ratios is okay, and there's case after case after case that does it. The list of the cases is Planned Parenthood, Baines, Hangarter, Zhang, Cooper, and then let's take a look at the Supreme Court trilogy. State Farm, TXO, and Cooper all on remand were single-digit ratios. So there is discussion of 1-1 and 4-1. However, the courts in action uphold single-digit ratio cases. And Cooper is the best example because in Cooper, you essentially have a company that has a bad photograph at a trade show, and the court describes the actions in Cooper as foolish more than reprehensible, and upholds a 9-1 award in Cooper.
That was something where if you didn't have punitives, you wouldn't have much of a deterrent at all. And one of the things that State Farm makes clear is if a lot of money is awarded against the defendant, the reluctance of people generally to pay a lot of money acts as a deterrent by itself, so a lower ratio is appropriate, ordinarily not greater than 4-1.
Okay, let me address that directly, and I want to address it in two ways. First of all, in this particular situation, you have 32,000 plaintiffs who were forced together in a mandatory punitive damage class as a result of action by Exxon Corporation.
I don't see the relevance of that argument that for each plaintiff it's not that much, because when you're looking at deterrence and punishment, the impact of deterrence and punishment fall on the defendant that's punished and deterred.
Let me.
You can have a class action where everybody in the class gets $1.50 and a coupon for a discount on their next car or something. The lawyers get $100 million, and the defendant is put out of business. That will sure deter.
It does. Let me address it, first of all, from the proposition from a legal standpoint. I didn't make it up. I got it from Planned Parenthood. And the holding in Planned Parenthood is, in looking at the size of the awards, you do look at it on a plaintiff by plaintiff basis. And here we have a collection of 32,000 plaintiffs with.
That was in the context of knocking it down, not building it up. We knocked the award way down in Planned Parenthood.
That's correct, but the proposition is clearly made in Planned Parenthood, and it relies on State Farm, which says that you're supposed to take a look at the harm to the individual plaintiff. Now, let me address it from a different perspective. The Amchem case, which we cite in our briefs, stands for the proposition that the imposition of the class structure on a variety of different plaintiffs is should not affect the substance of the claims of those individual plaintiffs. The class structure is to facilitate getting all of the cases through the courts. So that's a proposition, and that's a Supreme Court case, but that's an important proposition that supports that you should look at these on an individual
basis. Does your argument mean that in a class action, the punitive damages should be higher because the individual class members don't get that much?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. It strikes me as a basic proposition that if you have a case in which you have two people involved in a commercial transaction and the reprehensibility is low and there is a large financial award against one, that's one situation. But here, the fact that Exxon took chances with the livelihoods of 32,000 people, knowingly took chances with the livelihoods of 32,000 people, makes the conduct, at least from a common sense perspective, worse.
Well, may I ask you this, because I have a little problem with this case, and the things keep changing from phase to phase. What is the conduct here that you think is involved?
It is taking an individual who you know is an alcoholic, and you know is drinking again, and you know is drinking and driving, and you know is drinking and driving and leaving the bridge, and over a period of 3 years, despite warning after warning and despite knowledge from the top of the chain of command to the bottom of the chain of command, not doing anything about it. That's the reprehensible conduct. Everybody knew the good Captain Hazelwood had gone through rehab. Everybody knew he was drinking again. I mean, in this day and age where drunk driving, and indeed drunk driving in safety-sensitive positions, is such a huge, huge problem, allowing that to happen and in a situation in which you know you're going to hurt 32,000 people is a very bad thing.
How do you respond to the defendant's argument that under the ADA, companies that just fire people for being alcoholics, even when they get treatment, companies that won't let people blind in one eye drive big trucks can run afoul of ADA requirements?
I want to respond to it directly. That issue was tried. That was an Exxon defense. The Exxon defense was put forward by a fellow named Iorossi, who was the chairman, the president of the shipping company. Mr. Iorossi said that was a concern of his, and he talked it over with the human resources director, who told him that there was an issue there. Mr. Iorossi later on testifies that he wasn't involved at all in the decision and didn't learn about the decision until afterwards. The human resources director says that conversation never took place. So the issue of why, in fact, Hazelwood was put on the vessel was tried to the jury in this particular case. And it's clear that that wasn't the reason, and there are facts supporting an inference that that wasn't the reason. And if you take those facts most favorable to the jury verdict, that isn't the reason. It appears from the trial proof, and it was day after day. If you read the transcript reeks of alcohol. It was clear from the trial proof that Exxon Corporation, at least in the shipping company, had an alcoholic culture, that they were enablers, and that they were enablers from the top of the company to the bottom of the company, and they weren't going to do anything about Captain Hazelwood. That's the transcript. And this ADA defense was tried and argued to the jury, and the evidence...
You're saying the jury took that into account when it concluded what?
That the conduct was reprehensible. The evidence was such that the jury could have rejected it as a total fabrication. And we cite, if in our briefs, we cite to the Iorossi testimony and the testimony of a fellow named Ben Graves. And that's clear. We also cite in our briefs just to the ton of evidence that shows that this company was sick.
I guess I'm just trying to understand. Did that go to the jury? Did the jury take that into account with respect to the compensatory damages or what?
It was tried as part of the punitive damage case.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I do want to address your concern, and it was next in my outline, about the ratio. The Supreme Court cases clearly talk about the totality of the harm. And indeed, they talk about more than the totality of the harm. And TXO, the judgment of TXO, if you take into account just the quantified harm, was 385-1. So the cases uniformly talk about harm. They don't talk about the net punitive damage award. Now, the reason for that is kind of interesting.
Net compensatory damage award.
The net compensatory damage award, yeah. The reason for, if that was the regime, then the system would, you'd stand the system on its head for a variety of reasons. The first is, any time you did something wrong, you could get out of it by paying compensatory damages. There would never be any punishment. You make that judgment, you go out and settle. The second aspect of that is it takes the punishment decision away from society and away from the courts and places it in the hand of the wrongdoer, because the wrongdoer can always buy itself out quite simply by settling. The third reason it doesn't work
is... can buy itself out of a good deal of compensatory damage.
Well, it can, and it should be able to do that.
And it did here.
It did. And, you know, to answer your question...
What if Exxon had paid $5 billion in advance of any lawsuit being filed by anyone? It had gone around and said, we feel terrible about what we did. We don't want you to feel you have to sue us in order to get a sting. And had handed out $5 billion, the total amount that the jury found was due. Would you say that they should nevertheless be liable for another $5 billion?
Probably not.
If they had paid out, what, the compensatory plus $5 billion in
probably yeah. not. But you asked early on, with regard to these payments, where in the analysis do you place the payments? Exxon made a decision here as to how it wanted to do it when it tried the case. And it resulted in two things. The first was Exxon argued to the jury that its payments made it less reprehensible. And they got a jury instruction. I think the jury instruction number is 37, which allowed them to argue the voluntary payments in the context of everything that went on before and went on after. So it was part of the discussion with the jury about how bad it was, and it was argued that way. So that also, though, at the same time led to the damage stipulation. You know, we stipulated, too, what the harm was in the case. And the trial court's finding of $513 million takes that stipulation as the basis, and it resolves a couple of the open issues that were left in the trial stipulation.
Well, one of the things that I find difficult here is that, as I understand it, I mean, you are arguing that this was tried, this was found, this was taken into account. As I understand it, our standard with respect to due process review, which is what we're supposed to be talking about, is de novo. And so what is it, in your view, that we're supposed to be looking at de novo?
I'm going to answer the question honestly and not how I had planned to answer it.
well, that's refreshing.
Yeah. I realize that there are some who don't think that Ninth Circuit precedent is binding, but Supreme Court precedent is. And Cooper says that we do just what Judge Schroeder said.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, but you go down different levels, and I think her question says, at what level does the jury and the district court play a role, and at what level do we play a role? The ultimate decision of whether the award is grossly excessive is a de novo question. That's absolutely clear.
But what do we look at de novo in deciding that? We don't just say, what side of the bed did I get up on?
No, you don't. You take a look at the three BMW factors, and looking at reprehensibility, you take a look at the five reprehensibility factors. Now, that's a good example with regard to the question that you're asking. Are the findings with regard to each of the reprehensibility factors findings of fact, and do we get favorable jury inferences when you find out about something being repeated or purposeful, or are those questions of fact, or are those reviewed de novo? And that is right where it breaks down. The fact that Exxon knew about Hazelwood's drinking and all of the other facts that the district court made with regard to that are obviously findings of fact by the district court.
I think if I'm understanding you right, your intention with this sentence in the Supreme Court's decision in State Farm, they said, we reiterated the importance of these three guideposts in Cooper Industries and mandated appellate courts to conduct de novo review of a trial court's application of them to a jury's award. I had understood that to mean we don't just decide whether the award's excessive or not. We do de novo review of application of each of the three guideposts.
At the top level, but in order to do that review, you need facts. And the facts that go into that review are taken most favorably to the winner. And you say that in the first sentence in Baines. I mean, you do say it right in the first sentence in Baines. It gets mushy in the middle. I mean, when I said I'm going to talk about it honestly, it gets mushy in the middle. But you do have findings of fact with regard to harm and the amount of harm. You have findings of fact with regard to the specifics of the reprehensibility. And you have findings of fact with the maximum nature of the fines.
I don't understand. We don't have a special verdict. What do you mean by findings of fact?
The district court, and this again gets muddy.
And you want us to defer to what the district court said factually
in its last decision
when he was analyzing application of the three factors?
That's correct. On the factual issues, that's correct. And I think the Supreme Court makes that clear in State Farm. Beg pardon?
He didn't say he was making findings of fact.
If you read...
And I don't know if we could defer to him anyway under that sentence.
Well, I think Cooper indicates that you do defer to his findings of fact. Cooper was a jury case. And in Cooper, the district court in Cooper did exactly the same thing that you asked Judge Holland to do here. And Cooper talks about deferring to his findings of fact in a jury case. Another way to answer the same question is you've had three or four opinions in this case from Judge Holland. The first opinion was in the old context of reviewing the jury award. If you go back to the last opinion, the one that you're reviewing here, he talks in terms of finding facts. He thought that was your charge to him to find facts. And he takes into consideration the jury verdict, but the syntax, in his opinion, is a fact-finding syntax.
Well, the Supreme Court keeps kind of changing the...
Oh, I would say another thing on that. The way you phrased the question to me, Judge Kleinfeld, I think to some extent overstated what the nature of the inquiry is. The inquiry is the award grossly excessive? It isn't whether it's the proper award or near a proper award. The inquiry is this so far out of bounds that it violates the Constitution. And in this particular case, because of the number of people that were hurt, because of the amount of damage that was done, and because of the exceptional notice that Exxon Corporation had with regard to the ballpark that it was playing in, the punishment is fair. It's large, but it's fair.
Well,
we covered a lot of territory, and I'm attempting to find where I am in my outline. I did want to talk for a minute about what is a basic issue, and Mr. Dellinger raised it, and I want to raise it, and you raised it, and that is the deterrence with regard to what happened here and the sufficiency of the deterrence with regard to what happened here. And I have a couple of observations on that. The first is we know that prior to the grounding, Exxon knew both the dangers of putting Hazelwood in charge of the vessel and the dangers of having that vessel under his command in Prince William Sound. And that didn't deter him. I think because of the fact that they were not rational decision makers, as the district court found, and that they were operating in the context of this alcoholic culture. But we know that the scope of this damage, which happened pretty well as envisioned, was known to the company. And every aspect of this risk was known to the company almost to a certainty. They had perfect knowledge with regard to Joe. They had perfect knowledge with regard to the sound. They had perfect knowledge with regard to the fishermen. And they did it anyway, and they weren't deterred. My second observation on just the question of deterrence, and then I'll get to punishment, is the district court at some point in time.
I don't really get the deterrence. It seems to me like even if they were totally unmindful of the harm to the environment and the liability that they could be hammered with for harm to the environment, and even if they were totally unmindful of the economic harm to others and how they could be hammered for doing it, still they wouldn't want to lose their 11 million gallons of oil.
But they did.
I mean,
I understand.
They can't be indifferent to losing their cargoes.
Well, I understand. I understand that. But what were the facts? The facts at trial were they were indifferent to it. The facts at trial were they put this whole thing in play knowing where it was going to go. And that's what we tried. And they argued to the jury, oh, we wouldn't have, you know, I mean, this was a mere accident. They argued that to the jury, but that wasn't the proof.
You're saying any time somebody has an accident, that shows they were indifferent, utterly unmindful.
No, I'm saying every risk. I'm saying if you put a drunk in charge of a supertanker in Prince William Sound, Alaska, knowing what exactly the consequences of that are going to be, that is reprehensible conduct.
That has to be a jury question. I'm still struggling with this. What is it that we're reviewing de novo? That has to be a jury question as to whether or not they did this knowingly. I mean, what they did has to be for the jury.
That's a correct statement.
Now, the question of the reprehensibility of what they did, without being in the jury room, it's kind of hard to figure out to review de novo how reprehensible it is.
And let's discuss that both in the context of State Farm versus the Campbells in the context of this particular case.
Why don't you also discuss it in the context of Hilal versus the State of Marcos, the people that were tortured and killed by the Ferdinand
Marcos regime? That was a terrible case in which the punishment should have been
high. We said that was more reprehensible. Torturing and killing large numbers of people, we said, was more reprehensible than putting a drunk in charge of a supertanker.
I think it is more reprehensible. But I think with regard to the management of a supertanker business, putting a drunk in charge of a supertanker knowing that he's drinking is highly reprehensible. The Marcos case is worse. But compare this to the 9-1 in Cooper. I mean, Cooper's dumb conduct, but it isn't putting a drunk in charge of a supertanker. Now, with regard to reprehensibility in this particular case, Judge Schroeder, there were over 12 hours of testimony before Judge Holland by the top guys in the company. I went back and I read it and I timed it. There were over 12 hours by the former chairman, the next chairman, the president of the shipping company, and Judge Holland and the jury got an opportunity to take a look at these guys. And Judge Holland came to a couple of conclusions. In Order 267, he came to the conclusion that the evidence was sufficient for the jury to conclude that there was a lack of contrition by these specific people. And in Order 364, he came to the conclusion that Exxon has not come to grips with the opprobrium which society rightly attributes to drunk driving. There are findings that, at least as of the time of trial, 5 years after the grounding, Exxon management didn't get it. There's also documentary evidence in the record. A memo by a fellow named Stalzer and another memo by the former president of the shipping company, a fellow named Iarassi, that months and in one case years after the grounding, Exxon was still violating Coast Guard safety standards.
Help me with something more specific before your time runs out. My impression from the briefs was, frankly, that Exxon lowballed the numerator and your side highballed it. I guess we could expect that. What would the numerator be if you use as the numerator actual compensatory damages minus amounts paid before trial not before judgment, but before trial by this particular defendant. When Exxon tried to cut the numerator down, lowballing it, as I characterized it, it took credit for money that was paid by other parties, not just itself, and money that was paid after the trial commenced.
I think we run the number at $360
million. $360 million would be the numerator if you don't count prepays.
Prepays and a couple of other categories, and we do that calculation in the brief. There's a calculation.
Around page 46, something like that?
It is. It's towards the end, but we do the calculation at the brief. I would say, though, and this is probably the most important thing that I do want to say, and that is this case is like TXO in that there is an awful lot of emotional damage that was just the plain result of hurting 32,000 people's jobs. The nature of things tells you that that's the case.
If I understood that argument, you're trying to use the emotional damage that always flows from great economic harm to turn this into a personal injury case for purposes of that Supreme Court dichotomy between physical injury cases and economic harm cases. Is that right?
No. The first five-sixths of the statement about what I'm doing are correct. What I'm doing is I am relying on the proposition in footnote 11 of the Cooper decision. And footnote 11 of the Cooper decision, and in this Court's Planned Parenthood decision, and in other decisions, the proposition is recognized that there are other intangibles that go with economic harm, and in old-fashioned tort regimes, and admiralty is an old-fashioned tort regime, you take those things into consideration in assessing punitive damages. And footnote 11 in Cooper talks at great length about that. So I'm relying on footnote 11 in Cooper with regard to that. And I'm relying on TXO with regard to potential damage. If you take emotional distress and if you take, and I'm over my time.
Yeah, that's okay.
If you take emotional distress and you take potential harm together, it isn't a 9-to-1 case. This is only a 9-to-1 case if you take a look at the hard economic damages, which the Supreme Court precedent tells you that that's what you're supposed to look at.
Okay.
I won't even repitch. I'll thank you very much.
Question? Don't appear to be any. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, ma'am. Sir. Sir.
Or just very quickly, if you take the 19.5 million plus the state court judgment of 23 and you added to it the amounts that were paid prior to the judgment but after or during the trial, that would be another $70 million plus $70 million before the trial. $15 million were settlements post-trial but pre-judgment. That 20 plus 70 plus 15 gets you to $55 million. If you start the other way from 513, we take off the $300 million that was paid before.
Oh, hold on. I lost you there.
Okay.
I got different numbers when I went through my notes than your total. Give it to me again.
It's 20. I misread. I'm sorry. You did because I missaid it. It's the $20 million that was the judgment. The $20 million that was paid pre-judgment but post-trial, $15 million in settlement paid during trial, that is $55 million. The difference between that gap and the $513 million is the $300 million that was paid not just before judgment, but before trial, plus the $98 million in Alyeska funds and other matters. Just very quickly, Judge Kleinfeld, I don't see how you possibly get to $1 billion, even reading your opinion, because the one time I saw that number was with respect to, hypothetically, 18 U.S.C. 3571, the twice the loss. As I say, we don't think the loss is anywhere near 513. But State Farm came along and warns against the speculative use of criminal penalties because they're speculative and you don't meet the standard of proof. Secondly, 3553 of the sentencing guidelines cuts off that at whatever is necessary for punishment and deterrence. Thirdly, we know the answer because, as this Court said, the fine is a significant datum because at $150 million that was agreed to, it represents an adversarial judgment by the executive office of the state and federal governments who have public responsibility for seeking the appropriate law.
And that's punishment, your position.
That's punishment for the environmental harm.
We understand your position.
And this was a small this is a small piece. And finally, Judge Schroeder, the court did say that the reprehensibility is reduced by the expenditure of millions of dollars. Reprehensibility should be discounted to defend this act promptly and comprehensively. You said that. So I, with that, I thank you for your, unless the court has further.
Are you saying that the numerator, if you count compensatory damages minus amounts that were paid before trial began, and you don't give Exxon credit for amounts that other defendants paid, comes to around $150 million?
No, I don't think that's – I'm not sure what – in terms of giving them credit.
I had trouble following what you were saying.
Well, the judgment was $19 million. The if you take the amounts you ask about, how much of that was not paid before the trial but only during or after
Let's
the trial?
Let's start with the compensatory damages award. Well,
that was $19.5 million.
Okay.
And you add to that 20 plus 20, you add to that 20, another 20 and 15, which are the amounts that were paid before judgment but during trial. That gets you to $55 million. I don't know why you would possibly do it, but if you added the amount that was owed by Alyeska for their separate negligence, that is $98 million, which we think shouldn't be added.
We understand that.
Gotcha.
You have more than used your time.
Okay, good. Thank you.
The case just argued is submitted for decision. That concludes the court's calendar, and the court stands adjourned.